Lady Ramkin's coach rattled into the plaza, making a noise like a roulette wheel, and pounded straight for Vimes, stopping in a skid that sent it juddering around in a semicircle and forced the horses either to face the other way or plait their legs. A furious vision in padded leather, gauntlets, tiara, and 30 yards of damp pink tulle leaned towards him and screamed, "Come on, you bloody idiot!" One glove caught him under his unresisting shoulder and hauled him bodily onto the box. "And stop screaming," the phantom ordered, focusing generations of natural authority into four syllables. Another shout spurred the horses from a bewildered standing start to a full gallop. The coach bounced away over the flagstones. An exploratory tendril of flickering light brushed the reins for a moment and then lost interest. "I suppose you haven't got any idea what's happening," shouted Vimes against the crackling of the spinning fire. "Not the foggiest!" The crawling lines spread like a web over the city, growing fainter with distance. Vimes imagined them creeping through windows and sneaking under doors. "It looks as though it's searching for something," he shouted, "then getting away before it finds it is a first-class idea, don't you think?" A tongue of fire hit the dark tower of art, slid blindly down its ivy-grown flanks, and disappeared through the dome of Unseen University's library. The other lines blinked out. Lady Ramkin brought the coach to a halt at the far side of the square. "What does it want the library for?" she said, frowning. "Maybe it wants to look something up." "Don't be silly," she said breezily. "There's just a lot of books in there. What would a flash of lightning want to read?" "Something very short. I really think you could try to be a bit more help." The line of light exploded into an arc between the library's dome and the centre of the plaza and hung in the air a band of brilliance several feet across. Then, in a sudden rush, it became a sphere of fire which grew swiftly to encompass almost all the plaza, vanished suddenly, and left the night full of ringing violet shadows, and the plaza full of dragon. Who would have thought it? So much power so close at hand. The dragon could feel the magic flowing into it, renewing it from second to second, in defiance of all boring physical laws. This wasn't the poor fare it had been given before, this was the right stuff. There was no end to what it could do with power like this. But first it had to pay its respects to certain people. It sniffed the dawn air, it was searching for the stink of minds. Noble dragons don't have friends, the nearest they can get to the idea is an enemy who is still alive. The air became very still, so still that you could almost hear the slow fall of dust. The librarian swung on his knuckles between the endless bookshelves. The dome of the library was still overhead, but then it always was. It seemed quite logical to the librarian that since there were aisles where the shelves were on the outside, then there should be other aisles in the space between the books themselves, created out of quantum ripples by the sheer weight of words. There were certainly some odd sounds coming from the other side of some shelving, and the librarian knew that if he gently pulled out a book or two, he would be peeking into different libraries under different skies. Books bend space and time. One reason the owners of those aforesaid little rambling, pokey second-hand bookshops always seem slightly unearthly is that many of them really are, having strayed into this world after taking a wrong turning in their own bookshops, in worlds where it is considered commendable business practice to wear carpet slippers all the time and open your shop only when you feel like it. You stray into L-space at your peril. Very senior librarians, however, once they have proved themselves worthy by performing some valiant act of librarianship, are accepted into a secret order and are taught the raw acts of survival beyond the shelves we know. The librarian was highly skilled in all of them, but what he was attempting now wouldn't just get him thrown out of the order, but probably out of life itself. All libraries everywhere are connected in L-space. All libraries everywhere. And the librarian, navigating by book sign carved on shelves by past explorers, navigating by smell, navigating even by the siren whispering of nostalgia, was heading purposely for one very special one. There was one consolation. If he got it wrong, he'd never know it. Somehow, the dragon was worse on the ground. In the air, it was an elemental thing, graceful even when it was trying to burn you to your boots. On the ground, it was just a damn great animal. Its huge head reared against the grey of dawn, turning slowly. Lady Ramkin and Vimes peered cautiously from behind a water trough. Vimes had his hand clamped over Errol's muzzle. The little dragon was whimpering like a kicked puppy and fighting to get away. "It's a magnificent brute," said Lady Ramkin, in what she probably thought was a whisper. "I do wish you wouldn't keep saying that," said Vimes. There was a scraping noise as the dragon dragged itself over the stones. "I knew it wasn't killed," growled Vimes. "There were no bits. It was too neat. It was sent somewhere by some sort of magic, I bet. Look at it, it's bloody impossible. It needs magic to keep it alive." "What do you mean?" said Lady Ramkin, not tearing her gaze from its armoured flanks. What did he mean? What did he mean? He thought fast. "It's just not physically possible, that's what I mean," he said. "Nothing that heavy should be able to fly, or breathe fire like that, I told you."
"But it looks real enough. I mean, you'd expect a magical creature to be, well, gauzy."
"Oh, it's real. It's real, all right," said Vimes bitterly. "But supposing it needs magic like we need... like we need sunlight or food."
"It's a thaumivore, you mean?"
"I just think it eats magic, that's all," said Vimes, who had not had a classical education. "I mean, all these little swamp dragons always on the point of extinction. I suppose one day back in prehistoric times some of them found out how to use magic."
"There used to be a lot of natural magic around once," said Lady Ramkin thoughtfully.
"There you are, then. After all, creatures use the air and the sea. I mean, if there's a natural resource around, something's going to use it, aren't they? Then it wouldn't matter about bad digestion and weight and wing size and so on, because the magic would take care of it. Wow! But you'd need a lot," he thought. He wasn't certain how much magic you'd need to change the world enough to let tons of armoured carcass flit around the sky like a swallow, but he'd bet it was lots. All those thefts. Someone had been feeding the dragon. He looked at the bulk of the unseen university library of magic books, the great accumulation of distilled magical power on the Discworld. And now the dragon had learned how to feed itself. He became terribly aware that Lady Ramkin had moved, and saw to his horror that she was striding towards the dragon, chin stuck out like an anvil. "What the hell are you doing?" he whispered loudly.
"If it's descended from the swamp dragons, then I can probably control it," she called back. "You have to look them in the eye and use a no-nonsense tone of voice. They can't resist a stern human voice. They don't have the willpower, you know. They're just big softies."
To his shame, Vimes realized that his legs were going to have nothing to do with any mad dash to drag her back. His pride didn't like that, but his body pointed out that it wasn't his pride that stood a very reasonable chance of being thinly laminated to the nearest building. Through ears burning with embarrassment, he heard her say, "Bad boy!" The echoes of that stern injunction rang out across the plaza. "Oh, gods," he thought, "is that how you train a dragon? Point them at a melted patch on the floor and threaten to rub their nose in it?" He risked a peep over the horse trough. The dragon's head was swinging around slowly like a crane jib. It had some difficulty focusing on her, right below it. Vimes could see the great red eyes narrow as the creature tried to squint down the length of its own nose. It looked puzzled. He wasn't surprised.
"Sit!"
bellowed Lady Ramkin in a tone so undisobeyable that even Vimes felt his legs involuntarily sag.
"Good boy!"
"I think I may have a lump of coke somewhere," she patted her pockets. Eye contact. That was the important thing. She really, Vimes thought, shouldn't have looked down even for a moment. The dragon raised one talon in a leisurely fashion and pinned her to the ground. As Vimes half rose in horror, Errol escaped from his grip and cleared the trough in one leap. He bounced across the plaza in a series of wing-whirring arcs, mouth gaping, emitting wheezing burps, trying to flame. He was answered with a tongue of blue-white fire that melted a streak of bubbling rock several yards long but failed to strike the challenger. It was hard to pick him out of the air, because quite clearly even Errol didn't know where he was going to be, or what way up he was going to be when he got there. His only hope at this point lay in movement, and he vaulted and spun between the increasingly furious bursts of fire like a scared but determined random particle. The great dragon reared up with the sound of a dozen anchor chains being thrown into a corner, and tried to bat the tormentor out of the air. Vimes's legs gave in at that point, and decided that they might allow themselves to be heroic legs for a while. He scurried across the intervening space, sawed at the ready for what good it might do, grabbed Lady Ramkin by an arm and a handful of bedraggled ball gown, and swung her onto his shoulder. He got several yards before the essential bad judgment of this move dawned on him.
He went, mmm. His vertebrae and knees were trying to fuse into one lump. Purple spots flashed on and off in front of his eyes. On top of it all, something unfamiliar but apparently made of whale bone was poking sharply into the back of his neck. He managed a few more steps by sheer momentum, knowing that when he stopped, he was going to be utterly crushed. The Ramkins hadn't bred for beauty, they'd bred for healthy solidity and big bones, and they'd got very good at it over the centuries. A gout of livid dragon fire crackled into the flagstones a few feet away. Afterwards, he wondered if he'd only imagined leaping several inches into the air and covering the rest of the distance to the horse trough at a respectable run. Perhaps, in extremis, everyone learned the kind of instant movement that was second nature to Nobby. Anyway, the horse trough was behind him, and Lady Ramkin was in his arms, or at least was pinning his arms to the ground. He managed to free them and tried to massage a bit of life back. What did you do next? She didn't seem to be injured. He recalled something about loosening a person's clothing, but in Lady Ramkin's case that might be dangerous without special tools. She solved the immediate problem by grabbing the edge of the trough and hauling herself upright.
"Right," she said. "It's the slipper for you."
Her eyes focused on Vimes for the first time.
"What the hell's going on?" she began again, and then caught the scene over his shoulder. "Oh, sod," she said. "Pardon my Clatchian."
Errol was running out of energy. The stubby wings were indeed incapable of real flight, and he was remaining airborne solely by flapping madly like a chicken. The great talons swished through the air. One of them caught one of the plaza's fountains and demolished it. The next one swatted Errol neatly. He shot over Vimes's head in a straight rising line, hit the roof behind him, and slid down it.
"You've got to catch him!" shouted Lady Ramkin. "You must! It's vital!"
Vimes stared at her, and then dived forward as Errol's pear-shaped body slithered over the edge of the roof and dropped. He was surprisingly heavy.
"Thank goodness!" said Lady Ramkin, struggling to her feet.
"They explode so easily, you know. It could have been very dangerous." They remembered the other dragon. It wasn't the exploding sort. It was the killing people kind. They turned slowly. The creature loomed over them, sniffed, and then, as if they were of no importance at all, turned away. It sprang ponderously into the air, and with one slow flap of its wings began to scull leisurely away down the plaza and up into the mists that were rolling over the city. Vimes was currently more concerned with the smaller dragon in his hands. Its stomach was rumbling alarmingly. He wished he'd paid more attention to the book on dragons. Was a stomach noise like this a sign they were about to explode, or was the point you had to watch out for the point when the rumbling stopped?
"We've got to follow it," said Lady Ramkin. "What happened to the carriage?"
Vimes waved a hand vaguely in the direction that, as far as he could tell, the horses had taken in their panic. Errol sneezed a cloud of warm gas that smelt worse than something walled up in a cellar, poured the air weakly, licked Vimes's face with a tongue like a hot cheese grater, struggled out of his arms and trotted away.
"Where's he off to?" boomed Lady Ramkin, emerging from the mists, dragging the horses behind her.
They didn't want to come. Their hooves were scraping up sparks, but they were fighting a losing battle.
"He's still trying to challenge it," said Vimes. "You'd think he'd give in, wouldn't you?" "They fight like blazes," said Lady Ramkin, as she climbed onto the coach. "It's a matter of making your opponent explode, you see."
"I thought in nature the defeated animal just rolls on its back in submission, and that's an end of it," said Vimes, as they clattered after the disappearing swamp dragon.
"Wouldn't work with dragons," said Lady Ramkin. "Some daft creature rolls on its back, you disembowel it. That's how they look at it. Almost human, really."
The clouds were clustered thickly over Ankh-Morpork. Above them, the slow, golden sunlight of the disk world unrolled. The dragon sparkled in the dawn as it trod the air joyously, doing impossible turns and rolls for the sheer delight of it. Then it remembered the business of the day. They'd had the presumption to summon it. Below it, the rank wandered from side to side up the street of small gods. Despite the thick fog, it was beginning to get busy.
"What do you call them things like thin stairs?" said Sergeant Colan.
"Ladders," said Carrot.
"Lot of 'em about," said Nobby.
He mooched over to the nearest one and kicked it.
"Oi!"
A figure struggled down, half buried in a string of flags.
"What's going on?" said Nobby.
The flag-bearer looked him up and down.
"Who wants to know, Tiddler?"
he said.
"Excuse me, we do,"
said Carrot, looming out of the fog like an iceberg. The man gave a sickly grin.
"Well, it's the coronation, isn't it?" he said. "Got to get the streets ready for the coronation. Got to have the flags up. Got to get the old bunting out, haven't we?"
Nobby gave the dripping finery a jaundiced look.
"Doesn't look that old to me," he said. "It looks new. What are them fat, saggy things on that shield?"
"Those are the royal hippos of Ankh," said the man proudly. "Reminders of our noble heritage."
"How long have we had a noble heritage, then?" said Nobby. "Since yesterday, of course."
"You can't have a heritage in a day," said Carrot. "It has to last a long time."
"If we haven't got one," said Sergeant Colon, "I bet we'll soon have had one. My wife left me a note about it. All these years and she turns out to be a monarchist."
He kicked the pavement viciously.
"Hm," he said. "A man knocks his pipes out for 30 years to put a bit of meat on the table, but all she's talking about is some boy who gets to be king for 5 minutes' work. Know what was for my tea last night? Beef dripping sandwiches."
This did not have the expected response from the two bachelors.
"Caw," said Nobby.
"Real beef dripping," said Carrot. "The kind with the little crunchy bits on top, and shiny blobs of fat."
"Can't remember when I last addressed the crust on a bowl of dripping," mused Nobby, in a gastronomic heaven, "with just a bit of salt and pepper. You've got a meal fit for a king."
"Don't even say it," warned Colon.
"The best bit is when you stick the knife in and crack the fat, and all the browny gold stuff bubbles up," said Carrot dreamily. "A moment like that is worth a king."
"Shut up, shut up," shouted Colon. "You're just..."
"Ooh! What the hell was that?"
They felt the sudden downdraft, saw the mist above them roll into coils that broke against the house walls. A blast of colder air swept along the street and was gone.
"It was like something gliding past, up there somewhere," said the sergeant.
He froze.
"Here, you don't think..."
"We saw it killed, didn't we?"
said Nobby urgently.
"We saw it vanish," said Carrot.
They looked at one another, alone and damp in the mist-shrouded street. There could be anything up there. The imagination peopled the dank air with terrible apparitions, and what was worse was the knowledge that nature might have done an even better job.
"Nah," said Colon. "It was probably just some big wading bird or something."
"Isn't there anything we should do?" said Carrot.
"Yes," said Nobby. "We should go away quickly. Remember Gaskin."
"Maybe it's another dragon," said Carrot. "We should warn people and..."
"No," said Sergeant Colon vehemently, "because A, they wouldn't believe us, and B, we've got a king now. It's his job, dragons."
"That's right," said Nobby. "He'd probably be really angry. Dragons are probably, you know, royal animals. Like deer. A man could probably have his tridlins plucked for just thinking about killing one, when there's a king around."
Tridlins are a short and unnecessary religious observance performed daily by the holy balancing dervishes of Othurs, according to the Dictionary of Eye-Watering Words.
"Makes you glad you're common," said Colon.
"Commoner," corrected Nobby.
"That's not a very civic attitude," Carrot began. He was interrupted by Errol. The little dragon came trotting up the middle of the street, stumpy tail high, his eyes fixed on the clouds above him. He went right by the rank without giving them any attention at all.
"What's that with him?" said Nobby.
A clatter behind them introduced the Ramkin coach.
"Men,"
said Vimes, hesitantly, peering through the fog.
"Definitely," said Sergeant Colon. "Did you see a dragon go past, apart from Errol?"
"Well, said the sergeant, looking at the other two. "Sort of, sir. Possibly. It might have been."
"Then don't stand there like a lot of boobies," said Lady Ramkin. "Get in. Plenty of room inside."
There was. When it was built, the coach had probably been the marvel of the day, all plush and gilt and tasselled hangings. Time, neglect, and the ripping out of the seats to allow its frequent use to transport dragons to shows had taken their toll, but it still reeked of privilege, style, and, of course, dragons.
"What do you think you're doing?" said Colon, as it rattled off through the fog.
"Waving," said Nobby, gesturing graciously to the billows around them.
"Disgusting, this sort of thing, really.
mused Sergeant Colon. "People going around in coaches like this when there's people with no roof on their heads?"
"It's Lady Ramkin's coach," said Nobby. "She's all right."
"Well, yes, but what about her ancestors, eh? You don't get big houses and carriages without grinding the faces of the poor a bit."
"You're just annoyed because your missus has been embroidering crowns on her undies," said Nobby.
"That's got nothing to do with it," said Sergeant Colon indignantly. "I've always been very firm on the rights of man." "And dwarf," said Carrot.
"Yeah, right," said the sergeant uncertainly. "But all this business about kings and lords, it's against basic human dignity. We're all born equal, it makes me sick."
"Never heard you talk like this before, Frederick," said Nobby.
"It's Sergeant Colon to you, Nobby."
"Sorry, Sergeant."
The fog itself was shaping up to be a real Ankh-Morpork autumn gumbo. Like a pea super, only much thicker, fishier, and with things in it you'd probably rather not know about. Vimes squinted through it as the droplets buckled down to a good day's work, soaking him to the skin.
"I could just make him out," he said. "Turn left here."
"Any ideas where we are?"
said Lady Ramkin.
"Business district somewhere," said Vimes shortly.
Errol's progress was slowing a bit. He kept looking up and whining.
"Can't see a damn thing above us in this fog," he said. "I wonder if..."
The fog, as if in acknowledgement, lit up. Ahead of them it blossomed like a chrysanthemum and made a noise like vroom.
"Oh, no," moaned Vimes. "Not again."
"Are the cups of integrity well and truly suffused?"
intoned Brother Watchtower.
"Aye, suffused full well."
"The waters of the world, are they abjured?"
"Yea, abjured full mightily."
"Have the demons of infinity been bound with many chains?"
"Damn," said Brother Plasterer, "there's always something."
Brother Watchtower sagged.
"Just once it would be nice if we could get the ancient and timeless rituals right, wouldn't it? You'd better get on with it."
"Wouldn't it be quicker, Brother Watchtower, if I just did it twice next time?"
said Brother Plasterer. Brother Watchtower gave this some grudging consideration. It seemed reasonable.
"All right," he said. "Now get back down there with the others, and you should call me Acting Supreme Grand Master, understand?"
This did not meet with what he considered to be a proper and dignified reception among the brethren.
"No one said anything to us about you being Acting Supreme Grand Master," muttered Brother Doorkeeper. "Well, that's all you know, because I bloody well am, because Supreme Grand Master asked me to open the lodge on account of him being delayed with all this coronation work," said Brother Watchtower haughtily. "If that doesn't make me Acting Supreme Grand Bloody Master, I'd like to know what does, all right?"
"I don't see why," muttered Brother Doorkeeper. "You don't have to have a grand title like that. You could just be called something like, Rituals Monitor."
"Yeah," said Brother Plasterer. "Don't see why you should give yourself airs. You ain't even been taught the ancient and mystic mysteries by monks or anything."
"We've been hanging around for hours, too," said Brother Doorkeeper. "That's not right. I thought we'd get rewarded."
Brother Watchtower realized that he was losing control. He tried wheedling diplomacy.
"I'm sure Supreme Grand Master will be along directly," he said. "Let's not spoil it all now, eh, lads? Arranging that fight with the dragon and everything, getting it all off right, that was something, wasn't it? We've been through a lot, right? It's worth waiting just a bit longer, okay?"
The circle of robed and cowled figures shuffled in grudging agreement.
"Okay.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Certainly.
Okay, if you say so."
It began to creep over Brother Watchtower that something wasn't right, but he couldn't quite put a name to it.
He said, "Brothers?"
They, too, shifted uneasily. Something in the room was setting their teeth on edge. There was an atmosphere.
"Brothers," repeated Brother Watchtower, trying to reassert himself, "we are all here, aren't we?"
There was a worried chorus of agreement.
"Of course we are."
"What's the matter?"
"Yes."
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 There it was again, a subtle wrongness about things that you couldn't quite put your finger on because your finger was too scared. But Brother Watchtower's troublesome thoughts were interrupted by a scrabbling sound on the roof. A few nubs of plaster dropped into the circle. "Brothers," repeated Brother Watchtower nervously. Now there was one of those silent sounds, a long buzzing silence of extreme concentration and just possibly the indrawing of breath into lungs the size of haystacks. The last rats of Brother Watchtower's self-confidence fled the sinking ship of courage.
"Brother Doorkeeper, if you could just unbolt the dread portal," he quavered.
And then there was light. There was no pain, there was no time. Death strips away many things, especially when it arrives at a temperature hot enough to vaporize iron, and among them are your illusions. The immortal remains of Brother Watchtower watched the dragon flap away into the fog, and then looked down at the congealing puddle of stone, metal, and miscellaneous trace elements that was all that remained of the secret headquarters. And of its occupants, he realized, in the dispassionate way that is part of being dead. You go through your whole life and end up a smear swirling around like cream in a coffee cup. Whatever the gods' games were, they played them in a damn mysterious way. He looked up at the hooded figure beside him.
"We never intended this," he said weakly. "Honestly, no offence. We just wanted what was due to us."
A skeletal hand patted him on the shoulder, not unkindly, and Death said,
"Congratulations!"
Apart from the Supreme Grandmaster, the only elucidated brother to be away at the time of the dragon was Brother Fingers. He'd been sent out for some pizzas. Brother Fingers was always the one sent out for takeaway food. It was cheaper. He'd never bothered to master the art of paying for things. When the guards rolled up just behind Errol, Brother Fingers was standing with a stack of cardboard boxes in his hand and his mouth open. Where the dread portal should have been was a warm, melted patch of assorted substances.
"Oh, my goodness!" said Lady Ramkin.
Vimes slid down from the coach and tapped Brother Fingers on the shoulder.
"Excuse me, sir," he said. "Did you by any chance see what—"
When Brother Fingers turned towards him, his face was the face of a man who has hang-glided over the entrance to hell. He kept opening and shutting his mouth, but no words were coming out. Vimes tried again. The sheer terror frozen in Brother Fingers' expression was getting to him.
"If you would be so kind as to accompany me to the yard," said Vimes, "I have reason to believe that you—"
He hesitated. He wasn't entirely certain what it was that he had reason to believe, but the man was clearly guilty, you could just tell by looking at him. Not perhaps guilty of anything specific, just guilty in general terms.
Said
Brother Fingers. Sergeant Colon gently lifted the lid of the top box.
"What do you make of it, Sergeant?"
said Vimes, stepping back.
"It looks like a Clachian hots with anchovies, sir,"
said Sergeant Colon, knowledgeably.
"I mean the man,"
said Vimes, wearily.
Said
Brother Fingers. Colon peered under the hood.
"Oh, I know him, sir," he said. "Benji Lightfoot Bargis, sir. He's a capo de Monte in the Thieves' Guild. I know him of old, sir. Sly little bugger. Used to work at the university."
"What, as a wizard?" said Vimes.
"Odd job, man, sir. Gardening and carpentry and that."
"Oh, did he?"
"Can't we do something for the poor man?" said Lady Ramkin.
Nobby saluted smartly.
"I could kick him in the bollocks for you, if you like, my lady."
Said Brother Fingers, beginning to shake uncontrollably, while Lady Ramkin smiled the iron-hard, blank smile of a high-born lady who is determined not to show that she has understood what has just been said to her.
"Put him in the coach, you two," said Vimes, "if it's all right with you, Lady Ramkin."
"Sybil," corrected Lady Ramkin. Vimes blushed and plunged on.
"It might be a good idea to get him indoors, charge him with the theft of one book, to wit, The Summoning of Dragons." "Right you are, sir,"
said Sergeant Colon.
"The pitchers are getting cold, too. You know how the cheese goes all manky when it gets cold?" "And no kicking him, either,"
Vimes warned.
"Not even where it doesn't show. Carrot, you come with me."
Brother Fingers volunteered.
"'And take Errol,' added Vimes. "'He's driving himself mad here. "'Game little devil. I'll give him that.'
"'Marvellous when you come to think about it,' said Colon. "'Errol was trotting up and down in front of the ravaged building, whining.
"'Look at him,' said Vimes. "'Can't wait to get to grips.'
"'His gaze found itself drawn as though by wires up to the rolling clouds of fog.
"'It's in there somewhere,' he thought.